4081 or visit Eventbrite and search for Jerry Paris Retirement. Seating is limited.
Welcome to WPFW Washington at 89.3 FM in HD and at WPFWFM.org. This is the Hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Thank you for joining us. You're joining a Pacifica Radio Foundation station that's been in existence going on for 46 to 47 years because you, the listener, choose to support it both with your social connectivity and your financial support. I thank you, especially to those listeners who donated to our year-end drive. I thank you for supporting not only this program, but the station that gives you jazz and justice. For new listeners, We the People is a news magazine. We usually spend the hour with a one-to-one interview, and we cover issues and concerns involving race, history, politics, and culture, especially where they intersect, and especially when they leave us a legacy for actions for the future, building a better community, one broadcast at a time. Our guest today is Dr. Ralph Young. He's the professor of instruction in history at Temple University. He is the author of Dissent, The History of an American Idea, and the editor of Make Art, Not War, Political Protest Posters from the 20th Century, and Dissent in America, The Voices That Shaped the Nation. So without a doubt, you know our program is about dissent. American Patriots, Dissent. The history of America includes a history of dissent. Dissent has played a key role in shaping this country, calling many of us to fulfill what we have claimed and what we have written. Activists, both extraordinary and ordinary people, have called us to live up to our ideals. We'll examine the notion of dissent throughout our history with Dr. Young. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure. I know you've spent a great deal of teaching hours in your career examining this issue. Without further ado, let's just begin with a preliminary understanding or definition of dissent as you see it.
Well, dissent is essentially going against the grain. You know, it's people protesting against what is, whatever that is. And, you know, it's also a kind of an interesting thing about dissent is that when people protest for their rights, at some point, dissent movements always create their own counter-dissent movements. For example, when women were protesting for the right to vote in the 19th century, it spawned an anti-suffrage movement. Dissent has been you know, central to American history. In fact, my argument is that the United States itself is a product of dissent. Back in the 17th century, you had religious dissenters like Quakers and Puritans leaving Britain and coming over and founding colonies. No sooner had they got here than you had dissenters rise up amongst them. For example, Roger Williams in Massachusetts Bay Colony almost immediately began protesting that there wasn't enough religious freedom and that there was not enough separation of church and state. By the 18th century, you had political dissenters protesting against England's taxation policies, which of course led to the American Revolution, which is kind of an ultimate example of dissent. And the out of that revolution, when we wrote the Constitution, we put the right to dissent into the First Amendment. And so this has become really essential. And as I always say to my students, after the Constitution was ratified, basically Americans haven't shut up since. They've protested everything. Women protesting for the right to vote, abolitionists protesting against slavery. By the time you get to the 20th century, you have workers protesting for the right to unionize. You had every minority group protesting for their rights. And, you know, I think what was so important with the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, that so many Americans began to believe that these were like a contract. The American government made this contract with the people. You obey our laws, we will protect your rights. And over the course of history, so many groups have decided, well, you know, the rights that were supposedly guaranteed to us, we don't really enjoy them. And so people have protested for them. So this is, a strain that goes all the way through American history.
Well, being mindful of the upcoming commemoration of Dr. Martin Luther King, he said in his speech in Memphis in 1968, shortly before his assassination, all we say to America is to be true to what you said on paper. Somewhere I read, and he strategically pauses, of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read, strategically pausing again, of the freedom of the press. Somewhere I've read, again, strategically pausing, the greatness of America is the right to protest for right. And so, as you've demonstrated, Dr. Young, especially with your present book, American Patriots, A Short History of Dissent, this is a thread that's throughout our history from inception to the present. A little bit further of a deeper dive in getting a framework for understanding. It's not mere protest. It's not mere grievance. How do we begin to discern and therefore benefit from the process of examining dissent?
Yeah, well, the events of January 6th, which we've just celebrated that anniversary, the events of January 6th really got me to dive much more deeply into my own definition of dissent. And what I began to do is to think, okay, what did the founding fathers have in mind, the framers of the Constitution, when they wrote that right to dissent into the First Amendment? And it struck me that, you know, the whole thing with the establishment of the Republic, with the Constitution, this was an experiment. It was the first time people got together and consciously tried to work out a Constitution in which the people were in charge. Can the people rule themselves? And, you know, famously, as Benjamin Franklin was leaving the Constitutional Convention, a woman came up to him saying, you know, what form of government have you finally decided to establish? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it. And it struck me that when the founders wrote this right to dissent, it wasn't just a frivolous right. It was to, you have the right to dissent if your rights are not being fully valued or fully protected. And so in order for a democracy to flourish, in order for this republic to flourish, people had the right to, you know, protest for the rights that they were promised by this compact with the government. And what they were meaning by this also is that it was sort of the Americans' duty to protest for right. It was Americans' duty to push the United States to live up to its own moral code, what it put into the Constitution. And so that when people protest for rights, for example, the civil rights movement, or Latino rights, or the LGBTQ movement, when people are protesting to have these rights valued and protected, this is legitimate. This is pushing the United States to live up to its own commitment that it put on paper. If people are trying to push for their rights, but take away rights from other people, for example, like the Ku Klux Klan after the Civil War, the new reality was a slave-free society. So the Klan basically came into existence protesting for their rights, but they're protesting for the rights of white supremacy and to, put African Americans into a situation of second-class citizenship. This is basically, in my argument, unconstitutional. This is going against what the Constitution had and what the framers had in mind. And if it's unconstitutional, it's also un-American. So this is the kind of thinking that I got into after January 6th.
So might we say that dissent is for progression if we properly embrace it, as opposed to regression?
Yes, I mean, but there is a place for conservative dissent too, because you do want people to say, hey, wait a second, let's not move so quickly in this direction because maybe we're going to unleash some other problems. So conservative or regressive dissent has the impact of getting people to think more deeply about what the changes they want to make. But still, the way I look at it, dissent is really the fuel for the engine of progress. And it pushes the United States to, fully live up to its ideals.
So with that fuel, let's do the traveling through history, as your book has us to do. And at least early on, we quickly move from Abigail Adams reminding her husband to remember the ladies,
yes,
to the transcendentalist. And the transcendentalists offer us a very interesting understanding of at least the European inheritance of understanding both individuals and society. What is that in terms of dissent?
Well, with the transcendentalists and the kind of the leading ones that we think of are Emerson and Thoreau and Margaret Fuller. And they were people that they were influenced by a lot of different things, by the ideas of American democracy, by Hegelian philosophy. They were influenced by Buddhism and the Tao Te Ching, which had just been translated into English. And so they're bringing all this together. And one of the essential things about the transcendentalist was that we are all part of the Godhead, when you have these transcendental moments, when you're sitting by a stream, for example, and meditating, and you maybe suddenly feel how you understand everything, how you connect with the trees, with the water rippling by, with the birds singing in the trees. And you are at that moment, your individual soul is connecting with the oversoul of the universe. This is what Emerson called it. And so many, what Fuller and Thoreau and the others were writing about is that everybody needs to work to transcend the limits of our normal understanding and get into this deeper understanding where we see our connection with everybody else. And this is something that, and so many times, so many people have criticized the transcendentalists as being so individualistic and talking about human, their potential as humans. But they were not they were definitely also politically involved. Emerson and Thoreau especially were very much involved in abolitionism. Thoreau even used his cabin at Walden Pond as a stop for fugitive slaves in the Underground Railroad. And they felt that it was the duty of everybody to break unjust laws. And this, of course, winds up having a huge influence later on Martin Luther King, as well as Gandhi in India. And this, you know, when Thoreau was living at Walden, the Mexican War broke out. And the reason for the Mexican War is the United States, especially Southerners, wanted to expand the Cotton Kingdom into these northern provinces of Mexico. And this, of course, would strengthen slavery. And Thoreau said that he could not possibly support a government that supported the institution of slavery. And so he refused to pay his poll tax. He was arrested, spent a night in jail. And the result of that is he wrote his essay on civil disobedience, which has had a huge impact on dissenters ever since. I often tell my students it's sort of like the Bible of dissent movements. And famously, there's a story about how when Thoreau was in jail that night, Emerson came to visit him, and Emerson was sort of, you know, like shocked that his friend had got himself arrested. And he purportedly looked through the bars at Thoreau and said, "Henry, what are you doing in there?" And Thoreau purportedly looked back out through the bars and said, "You know, Ralph, what are you doing out there?" In other words, you should be breaking these laws too. And this was, and so with the Transcendentalists, they definitely believe that every single person should have the ability to live up to their full potential for self-realization, self-awareness. And they're also thinking that, of course, we are all connected with each other. And so what do you think they would think about slavery, for example? That it's not only wrong, but it's illogical, because how can God own God? If we are all part of divinity, how can one person own somebody else?
And allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Ralph Young, who's a professor of instruction in history at Temple University. His latest book, American Patriots, A Short History of Dissent, from NYU Press, is the basis of this conversation. Before we leave this, dare I say it, motley group of Transcendentalists and the legacy they leave us, can we highlight Margaret Fuller in particular and what lasting legacy she left us?
Yeah, and her legacy, of course, is more kind of one of the foundations of the women's movement. Back, you know, in the 1840s, you know, really before the suffrage movement got underway and to any great extent, she argued very much that, just like the Transcendentalists were arguing that, you know, one person could not own another in slavery, she also argued that there was no difference between the feminine and the masculine. She said in her book, Woman of the 19th Century, that in every man also resides the feminine principle, and in every woman resides the masculine principle. And that, she said that genius knows no gender. The spirit knows no sex. This is, you know, the inner quality of an individual is so much more important and is absolutely the same for everybody than things like gender or race or ethnicity, and that we're all connected.
So she gives us an example of intersectionality, and another person who will do that is Ida B. Wells. But I want to say, and I'll continue this pursuit throughout our conversation. So if I'm gathering, especially in the early periods of this country, there are people who speak up and say humanity, human being and being a human being are very, very important. But there's also a sense of being placed in society, and there's a sense of collectiveness. And surely people, for being who they are sometimes mistreated not only as individuals, but as a class of people. Ida B. Wells certainly steps up into this position. And with her courage and fortitude, she demonstrates a number of things.
Yes. She was, a contemporary of W.E.B. Du Bois and also Booker T. Washington, and really was perhaps the most courageous of all of the African-American role models at this time, because she really started a major campaign to get anti-lynching, federal anti-lynching legislation passed. And what she did is she wrote a number of pamphlets and books and newspaper articles detailing the horrors of lynchings of, unarmed African-Americans in the South, primarily men, but, also women as well. And her effort was to try to, and she would describe in terrible, horrible detail, people being burnt at the stake and body parts being cut off, et cetera. And her idea was to rouse up the public to be outraged about this, and so that they would pressure the government to create anti-lynching laws. And the idea, of course, it had to be a federal law, because in southern states especially, no jury, local jury, is ever going to convict a white man of killing a black man. And so it had to be something that you would take it out of the hands of local juries and have a federal jury and judge try these things. And then that would perhaps reduce the frequency of lynching. And she had such an impact that in 1900, one congressman actually introduced the first anti-lynching bill. But from 1900 all the way to 2022, there were more than 200 anti-lynching bills introduced to Congress, and every one of them were tabled or filibustered to death until finally just, 2 years ago, in February of 2022, the first and only anti-lynching bill was signed into law by President Biden. So it took a long time.
As many moments and periods of social change require, unfortunately.
Yes.
So we're getting an understanding of dissent. And again, listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But more importantly, our guest is Dr. Ralph Young, who's a professor of instruction and history at Temple University, and the author of the book fueling this conversation, Dissent in America, The Voices That Shaped a Nation. So again, to strategically reiterate, we're understanding this notion of dissent is helping us move through changing contexts, through new technologies, through new, I'm going to say it a little bit too early, but through culture wars or contestments in society. And somehow, thank you, Dr. Young, we're progressing into the 20th century, and with the early turn there. The one thing I also want to say is it requires something of us to understand the importance of dissent. Often the noise or context of where we're at and what we're experiencing in history can make it difficult but not impossible. Difficult but not unenjoyable. So, and I'm still with you, Dr. Young. I think our audience, there we go.
Yeah.
So with that movement, we can note figures that are highlighted, but the reason I was talking about things being muted is that we often don't remember important historical figures, and we don't remember the price that's paid with dissent. Mother Jones would be an important example that illustrates this point.
Yeah, she was really a very interesting person. When she was about 30 years old, her husband and all of her children died in, I think it was a yellow fever epidemic. And she devoted the rest of her life, and she lived to be 100, to causes like the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, with socialism. She was involved with the founding of both the IWW and the NAACP. And one of her pet grievances with the government was child labor, and she wanted the government to pass laws that would allow children to experience childhood and not have to go out and work in these sweatshops and textile mills and such, which so many children were being exploited, and therefore they couldn't even get an education. And, you know,
and quite frankly, just to amplify that, they were getting killed.
Yes.
A factory machinery, losing limbs.
Exactly.
Working in things that and situations that impacted their health quite severely.
Right. And there was no such thing in those days as any kind of safety regulations within the factories and the workplaces. And so she led a, at the age of 70, she led a children's march from Philadelphia to New York, where they, you know, she brought all these kids who had, you know, some of them had lost limbs, some of them were stooped over from, you know, backbreaking work and such. And the idea was to go eventually to Oyster Bay, where President Theodore Roosevelt was living, and so for him to see the plight of these children, and therefore to, and, you know, push the Congress to pass an anti-child labor, you know, to child labor laws.
So their march was from, I believe, outside of Philadelphia to Long Island, New York.
Yes. Yeah. So it took several days. And she's, you know, it was really great. She said, you know, like one of the things she comments that they stopped at Princeton. She asked the mayor if they could speak to the people because she wanted to speak about higher education. And she had this very snarky sort of way about her and caustic. She's talking about how, she's brought these children there so that they can see that the rich people who own the textile mills, you know, exploit these children. So these children have no education at all in order for their daughters to get higher education at places like Princeton so they could speak French to their police dogs and stuff. And so she even, you know, she didn't get a comment in about higher education, but it was really all about exploitation of children.
And she appealed to the president, who refused to see the children of the march.
Correct.
But you pointed out during their trek, she spoke to many different audiences.
Yep.
And so maybe one thing to highlight is authoritative powers who are intermediaries, pardon the expression, don't always whip heads and brutalize people, but that dissent has a moral power and compass.
Yes.
And so these children were, am I right, they were sheltered and fed.
Yes.
And thankfully, even the mainstream news media kind of got the message of the cruelty and inhumanity that they suffered.
Yes. And eventually it did, you know, under Wilson, some child labor laws were signed, and then later under Franklin D. Roosevelt. It still took a while, but it got the conversation going. And that's another thing about almost all dissent movements. What they're trying to do is get a conversation going. This is a problem. We need to solve it and get people talking about it and debating it and arguing about it, and then finally get some progress. One of my students once pointed out in a class conversation that he said that dissent is like the process of erosion, thinking of, you know, the ocean hitting the side of a mountain and eventually it turning into sand. And what happens is that, you know, dissenters are pushing against the what is and getting people to change their assumptions about race or gender, whatever the issue might be. And eventually the process of erosion erodes those basic assumptions and starts creating a new model, a new set of assumptions that people have. And I think that's, you know, kind of one way to look at how dissent works. It's, you know, a process of getting people to rethink their basic assumptions about whatever the topic might be and start thinking more deeply about it.
Keeping us on the arc toward justice, so to speak.
Yes, yes.
Listeners, you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. This hour is We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, Dr. Ralph Young, who's a professor of instruction and history at Temple University and the author of American Patriots, A Short History of Dissent, is with us talking about that very topic. We're at the halfway point in our show, and we usually do, in service to you, the listener, public service announcements. Will you stay with us, and we'll continue our conversation about this persistent and important thread of American history and society after these messages. Stay with us, won't you?
ADASI, the African Diaspora Ancestral Commemoration Institute, will host a free DC Emancipation Day program entitled Black Liberation Struggles in Global Africa. Then and now, on Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Enlightened Inc., 1205 Marion Barry Avenue Southeast. The program will commemorate the enslaved ancestors who crossed over the Old Navy Yard Bridge, the precursor to the 11th Street Bridge in Southeast, from enslavement in Maryland to freedom in the District of Columbia after the abolition of slavery in D.C. on April 16th, 1862. It will feature esteemed historian C.R. Gibbs and many others. For information, please call 202-505-2896 or visit adasiancestors.org. That's A-D-A-C-I ancestors.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
For helping us. For instance, you can listen to Africa Now, 1 p.m. Eastern Wednesdays, right here at WPFW with host Mwiza Mutali. My dear colleague Mwiza talks along with his team about the not only the African continent, but the diaspora, African descended people throughout the world, talking about matters of politics, history, and culture as we do here on our program. Again, thank you for supporting the station, and we'll now return to our conversation. Dr. Young, thank you for being with us. We're trying to do a steady progression through history, and again, a marker of dissent, not always, is a distrust of centralized authority and the abuses that come thereof. And so the issue of the power of government, particularly of a nation, is often the object of dissent. And we're progressing out of the progressive period. Unless there's something else that you want to mention, let's look to the historical figure of Eugene Debs, who really does inform us of a lot of what went on in American society and what continues to go on.
Yeah, he, a very, very interesting fellow. In the 1890s, he was the head of the Railway Workers Union and led a strike that was eventually, you know, broken up by the federal government. And because there was an injunction against the strike, he was put on trial. And during his trial, the prosecution kept accusing him of being a socialist. And he was eventually sentenced to 6 months in prison. And while he was in prison, he decided, well, you know, what is this socialism that I'm being accused of? So he decided to read up on it. He read a whole bunch of pamphlets and books about socialism. And the result was, by the time he got out of prison, he founded the American Socialist Party. And starting in 1900, he became, I think, five times the Socialist Party candidate's president, for president in the United States. During World War I, he ran afoul of the federal government by leading, you know, giving a lot of speeches denouncing World War I. And of course, arguing from a socialist standpoint is that there's no reason why the French and the English and the German and the American working class have to fight each other, because they're really doing the bidding of the owners of, you know, of capital within society. And his socialist argument is that if the workers of all the world would see this, they would realize they have much more in common with the workers, say the German workers with the French workers, than they do with their respective governments. Anyway, he gave some really scathing speeches against the American policy in World War I, which ran him afoul of the Espionage Act. And he was sentenced to prison for a number of years. And in 1920, he actually conducted his entire presidential campaign from within a prison cell. It's kind of ironic that if Trump gets convicted of anything, he might be leading a presidential campaign from a prison cell as well. But that's another story. But anyway, he eventually, after the war was over and Wilson was out of office and Warren G. Harding was elected president, Harding, a conservative Republican, actually commuted Debs' sentence and released him from prison. But he's, you know, a real hero of the American left, of the workers. He's one of Bernie Debs,
Bernie Sanders, yes.
Bernie Sanders' heroes. Quite often when I have students read some of Debs' speeches, he really resonates with people today.
And something that leaps out is, and I hope we haven't downplayed it, but dissent is met with a lot of brutality, violence, and coercions, and very ugly, beyond rhetoric, social dynamics, let's say. Yeah. And but something that leaped out as we're leaving the progressive period and as early as the onset of the 20th century, this red baiting and red scare stuff. And the one thing that's notable about Debs is that you have, and maybe this is a false romanticization, this appeal is universal. His rhetoric, his speeches, his address, his actions, his behaviors are contemplated. So in the Midwest, I mean, you have Fighting Bob LaFollette, and you have Minnesota and Wisconsin actually electing socialist leaders. And the basis of the socialism is not necessarily Bolshevik or Marxist ideology. Can you help us out further in understanding the distinctions here that I'm grappling at?
Well, a lot of this has to do with trying to, you wound up getting a lot of populists in the Midwest in the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century, very much protesting against the business interests, Wall Street and the bankers of the East.
So there's another centralized power besides government.
Yes. Yeah. And it's the economic oligarchs, or as FDR later termed them, economic royalists, who basically are kind of running the country and as far as FDR was concerned, was the cause of the Great Depression. But the earlier you had one of the big issues that people in the Midwest had was there had been so many crop failures because of bad weather and other things. And it was already the beginning of agribusiness. So many small farmers were losing their farms to banks, and banks would, auction them off, and businesses were buying them up. And some farmers, they were lucky if they got a job working on their own farm, but for somebody else. And they began demanding that there should be more money released, because the United States was on the gold standard then. And they basically argued for bimetallism. In other words, that the amount of money that we issue should be based on silver as well as gold. And this was one of the really big, big issues back in the 1890s and right up through the McKinley presidency. And incidentally, it was one of the propagandists for the populist was Frank Baum, who wrote a book about the yellow brick road, which was the gold standard. And in his original book, Dorothy Wears Silver Slippers. And this and the Wizard of Oz was basically some puppet, manipulated by Wall Street in the background. And so, most people don't realize that this famous children's story was really a very strong populist, almost verging on socialist kind of tract, denouncing the moneyed interests of the East.
So we are beginning to understand the use of the public square, the public at large, of art, of messaging, of symbols. But I didn't want to neglect something. Talking about engaging presidents and addressing presidents directly, William Monroe Trotter is an important influence, at least to journalists who are Black or of African-American descent.
Yes.
And he's an early example of the boldness that's often required in addressing powers. Yes. Just inform us a little bit about William Monroe Trotter before we leave this period.
Yeah, well, what he was, along with W.E.B. Du Bois and a number of others, met at Niagara Falls around 1900, and they started the Niagara Movement, which later evolves by 1909 or so into the NAACP. And so he was one of the really strong civil rights leaders at the time. And Wilson, famously, even though he was a progressive, a liberal Democrat, he was also an rabid segregationist. He basically introduced segregation into Washington, D.C. And William Monroe Trotter once had a, let me see if I can find this in the, he writes, he goes and visits Wilson and the White House. And Wilson, of course, has his campaign slogan was the new freedom that he was bringing. And he says, you know, he says this directly to the president. He says, have you a new freedom for white Americans and a new slavery for your African-American fellow citizens? And this was right after Wilson had commented that the 1915 film Birth of a Nation was a great film, which of course, you know, glorified the Ku Klux Klan.
So he's capitalizing on the dutiful patriotism of Black soldiers who were among many who got lynched and boldly challenging basically a racist president.
And he was, you know, speaking truth to power. Mm-hmm. And this was something that, you know, Wilson is like so many of our past presidents or and even more recent ones, is a very complicated figure. I mean, think of Jefferson owning slaves and, of course, writing the Declaration of Independence. And there are so many contradictions within people that are in the power structure, but and even also amongst the dissenters themselves. I mean, we're all human, so everybody has their foibles. Everybody has their dark side to them as well.
Speaking of which, we're in the jazz age, at least in the progression of your book, and I don't want to neglect several things that that age offers us. First, we'll start with a positive thing. And I know you spent part of your teaching career about art and propaganda and posters and such. Mm-hmm. But the jazz age is really a demonstration of how dissenters use the arts to advocate for justice. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, I think it's arts are one of the major successful and really good ways of getting across a dissenting message, whether you're doing a poster or whether you're doing, writing a song. It has this immediate emotional impact on people. So people could see a poster and it suddenly hits them better than, a 90-minute speech, or they listen to a song by somebody like Robert Johnson or Pete Seeger or Bob Dylan, and that, it hits them, kind of almost like as an epiphany, more, with a much, deeper impact than reading a 20-page essay denouncing the moneyed interests or the powers that be. So art and music, I think, are two of the really exceptional ways of getting across a dissenting message. And in the 1920s, with the Harlem Renaissance and with the with jazz and the blues coming north, and this really did a lot to break down a lot of racial barriers. With the home run, you had like Langston Hughes, you had writers, you had poets. This had a big impact, but not everybody reads poetry or high literature, but everybody loves music. And with, you know, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith, Mississippi John Hurt, Robert Johnson, all of these. And of course, it coincided with the invention of radio and the recording industry. And so this was getting out to a lot of people. And you wound up, probably everybody's seen that movie, The Cotton Club and such, you know, how whites would flock to these places in Harlem on the weekends and be exposed to African-American music. And I think that really did a lot, along with other trends in the 20s, like Marcus Garvey and such. But a lot of this really helped to kind of fuel the foundation of the later civil rights movement that comes in after this period of time.
So with the time that we have at hand, I want to even pick up our pace a little bit more quicker. Mm-hmm. We kind of gave the Great Depression a short shift, but I'd like to talk about maybe some examples that inform us currently. And you were talking about that sometimes dissent can be either negative or of a conservative bent. Mm-hmm. And the name we don't hear often is that of Father Coughlin. Mm-hmm. What does Father Coughlin offer us that bridges the period of FDR to today?
Well, Coughlin's a very interesting character. He started off, called the radio priest. He had this radio show that was hugely popular, much more so than the Rush Limbaughs and the present day stuff. I mean, millions of people would be listening to Father Coughlin's weekly radio addresses. And at the beginning, when Roosevelt was elected, Father Coughlin was very pro-Roosevelt and very much anti-capitalist. But he eventually began to become disillusioned with Roosevelt because he wasn't punishing these capitalists enough. He felt they should be all locked up in prison and such. And then he started in his critique of Roosevelt getting into anti-Semitism. And they were the Jewish industrialists, the Jewish bankers. He started calling the New Deal the Jew Deal. And this was at a time when Kristallnacht was happening in Europe and Hitler was rising to power. And eventually Coughlin was, the Bishop of Detroit took him off the radio because of his anti-Semitism. But he was kind of an interesting character in that starts off as almost like a socialist and then becomes really almost fascist.
And along with Charles Lindbergh, a key player in the American First,
yes.
Movement, which we're hearing now.
Yep.
So, Dr. Young, I have to apologize to you in a certain regard. I wanted to make sure we covered civil rights in the 60s, what Fannie Lou Hamer offered us, mm-hmm. a name that other listeners won't be or most listeners won't remember, but John Howard Lawson and his pushback against the House and Americans Committee. But it's unfair to you, but what could we learn of the following touch points? The civil rights movement, the SDS movement, and the peace movement. What can we keep in mind in the last few minutes? And then I have a closing question.
Well, with the 1960s, I think this was a period of time, and there were a lot of factors involved with it, the baby boom generation, the Kennedy assassination, the idealism that Kennedy had provoked, the early civil rights movement under, with the Montgomery bus boycott and such. All of these things wound up becoming extremely inspiring for a lot of people. And I think for many young people in America, suddenly all of those ideals from the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were really taken seriously. And people like with the Students for a Democratic Society, when the with the Port Huron statement, they speak about how, you know, we grew up believing very deeply in all of these things that, you know, the moral correctness of the American society, and we really believe these things. And, you know, but it also occurred to us that there were things that were problematic. And, you know, like personally, for example, you know, my own experience, like growing up in the 50s, was taught in school all the time that the United States is the greatest country in the world because everybody is free and equal. And I love that. I thought it was so wonderful. And I was so lucky to be born in the greatest country on earth. And then in 1957, you turn on the television and you see these nine black students being escorted into Little Rock Central High School by the United States Army. And you're saying to yourself, hey, we're the greatest country because everybody's free and equal, but it's not true. And I think this is one of the things that really kicked off the whole 60s rebellion, is that so many people were thinking that, okay, this is the greatest country, but we have some problems, so let's fix them. Let's make the reality in the United States more closely resemble our ideal image of ourselves.
And that imperative is still being held on today. What is your hope with that? And I also wanted to acknowledge that you said in your book that Pete Seeger and Allen Ginsberg were influencers.
Yes.
Yours.
Yeah, I've met both of them, and they were actually very accessible. You know, you could just sit around and talk with them. They were not like filled with this egocentric fame kind of thing. And I remember, one of the things, a friend of mine was once interviewing Pete Seeger and asked him, well, Mr. Seeger, can you change the world with a song? And I loved his response. He said, no, I can't change the world with a song. But if I write a song and someone else paints a poster and someone else leads a teach-in and someone else gives a speech and someone else leads a demonstration, together we can change the world.
And on that note, with the time that we have, I want to just thank you again, thanking Dr. Ralph Young, who's a professor of instruction and history at Temple University and the author of American Patriots, A Short History of Dissent. Dr. Young, thank you for this hour. It's obvious that we have to probably have you back on again at your pleasure and talk about even more contemporary examples in our current situation. But yes. I thank you for inspiring us about the importance of dissent and how we should hold on to it.
Well, thank you very much. This is I wish we could talk for another hour on this, but thank you so much.
Well, that does it for this hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Thanking you for listening to WPFW and supporting your Jazz and Justice radio station. Coming up at 1, Africa Now with host Moesa Mutale. At noontime, don't forget the blues with Clarence the Bluesman Turner. We do that every weekday at that hour. And immediately following this program is the news. I believe Sue Goodwin will bring it to you. And my thanks to the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW. Last but not least, Mike Nasella. Thank you, my engineer. Thank you for bringing the show week after week. And I thank you, the listeners, for tuning in. Take good care. Perhaps we'll meet again on the radio. Take care now. Our blood now.
sunset leaves us to our tears. More, more, more lawmakers cry. And the name.
Dori Ladner was a courageous civil rights activist. Her legacy lives on every time we choose to confront injustice. Dori Ladner's funeral will be held this Saturday, April 13th, at Shiloh Baptist Church, 1500 9th Street, Northwest, D.C., at 11 a.m. All are welcome to come and bid farewell to this icon of the civil rights movement. WPFW extends condolences to the family of Dori Ladner.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, April 10th. Here are some headlines. Former Trump Organization executive Alan Weisselberg was sentenced today to 5 months in jail for lying during court testimony in a civil fraud lawsuit against Trump. Weisselberg had pleaded guilty last month to 2 counts of perjury, including telling the court he had no idea how a Trump property value was inflated on financial documents. Weisselberg already served 100 days in jail last year for tax fraud at the Trump Organization. His legal fees are being paid by the Trump Company, where he worked for nearly half a century. In other news, the Environmental Protection Agency today issued the first ever national rule to limit the presence of certain PFAS, or so-called forever chemicals, in drinking water. These chemicals have been linked to cancers, liver damage, as well as developmental damage in children. Contamination exposure has also been found to disproportionately affect communities of color. The new rule is expected to reduce exposure to the highly toxic chemicals for about 100 million people. Utilities will now need to look for 6 of these chemicals in drinking water and remove them if they exceed EPA limits. The FAA says it is investigating new whistleblower claims made by a Boeing quality engineer that accused Boeing of poor safety standards. The whistleblower alleges the company is employing shortcuts in the assembly process of 787 Dreamliners that could possibly compromise the structural integrity of the aircraft. This comes amid a series of high-profile incidents involving Boeing's aircraft. In the past few months, planes have lost landing parts, door panels, and just this week, a Boeing plane was forced to land after an engine cover came off. A Senate subcommittee has called Boeing CEO David Calhoun to testify next week regarding the safety of the company's aircrafts. Arizona's Supreme Court ruled yesterday that an 1864 law banning virtually all abortions in the state can go into effect. The law says doctors or others who perform an abortion can be prosecuted unless the mother's life is in danger. The law does not include exceptions for rape or incest. Democrats immediately decried the ruling in the key election battleground state, while Governor Katie Hobbs said it would create more chaos for women and doctors in the state. The ruling comes a day after former President Trump said abortion policy decisions should be left to states. And overall, more than 30 million people across the southeast U.S. are under a severe storm threat, while flood watches are in effect for over 13 million people from Texas to Georgia, according to the Storm Prediction Center. Meteorologists anticipate potential flash floods in parts of eastern Texas, northern Louisiana, and western Mississippi, where isolated rainfall totals could exceed 6 inches. There have already been reports of baseball-sized hail and fierce winds across the region, including a report of wind gusts at 88 miles per hour in Texas, according to the Weather Service. And in weather in Washington, D.C., it is 73 degrees under partly cloudy skies. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in